Hello and welcome to Playwright, a podcast about creating and sharing new ways to play. My name is Ryan Heyman. You can call me H.
And I'm Ryan Quintel. You can call me Q.
Today, a game caught my eye. It released today, or specifically came out of early access at where it had been for a while. But it was, I don't know, or I have any special way to intro it, just that it feels like it incorporates a lot of really clever mechanics in really brilliant ways. And so I just wanted to highlight it for all the Playwright listeners that it might be something that they're into. It is called Curse of the Dead Gods. Do you know this one at all while it was in early access? I think you are a little bit more in tune with the early access scene than I tend to be.
Curse of the Dead Gods. I just saw IGN give it like an 8 or 9 or something, right?
Yeah, so it is a top-down action roguelite. So, you know, kind of following on the at the foot of Hades from last year, obviously setting a very high bar. But I really love the things that this particular game is doing. So you are playing an explorer that is kind of delving into these ancient tombs, kind of Indiana Jones style, and fighting monsters there within, collecting treasure, stuff like that. But you have to kind of grapple with this light and darkness mechanic. You have a torch that you can pull out at any time, and it kind of takes the place of your, you know, main hand weapon. So, you know, you can't use your main weapon and the torch at the same time. It has that great kind of like pre-release Dark Souls 2 before they basically remade the entire game so that the core mechanic was stripped out of it. Mm. It has that the whole thing going for it. But it's neat because when you're standing in the light, I guess that's kind of the default state. When you're in the darkness, you can no longer see environmental traps, so those are invisible to you. And you also take, I think it's either 25% or 50% more damage from enemies. And so you're always kind of, when you're entering combat encounters, you can either go straight for your kind of main weapon, do the most amount of damage. Enemies don't disappear in the darkness. You know, you can still see them and still very functionally fight them in the darkness. But, you know, obviously you're putting yourself more at risk, or you can go into the battle with your torch drawn and either look for like a brazier that you can light, which will, you know, stay lit for a significant amount of time. Some of them, I think, just burn forever. Some of them, I think, burn out after a little while to light the area. So, you know, performing kind of an environmental, almost like a puzzle-ish task before engaging in the combat. Or you could swipe your flame at an enemy, catch them on fire, which doesn't do a lot of damage. You're kind of trading off what could be a more impactful first hit. But while the enemy is on fire, they provide light in, you know, a certain radius. And so, you know, they counterbalance some of those negative effects. But of course, then you have to kind of prioritize not killing the enemy that's currently on fire, so that they continue to spread light, because once they die, then the light goes out as well. And then there's a separate mechanic of kind of like a sanity damage, like you would find in like a Darkest Dungeon or in Eternal Darkness or something like that. Your character kind of builds up like a insanity or like a curse meter as certain enemies can inflict this kind of alternate damage onto you, or you can incur that from healing yourself at certain areas, or, you know, there are lots of ways to kind of build up this curse, which, you know, again, is very appropriate as you're kind of exploring these like ancient Aztec temples and stuff like that. The curses, once they hit certain thresholds, you are cursed by the gods, but each of the curses have both kind of positive and negative attributes to them. So it's not like, it's not inherently negative. It's not inherently bad. You know, I could see plenty of strategies where you would try to get cursed or try to, like, you know, rush to get cursed in early rooms so that you just kind of have that, that behind you. And maybe you can take advantage of, you know, a lot of them are like, you know, you take 75% more damage, but you do 50% more damage yourself, and, you know, things that make things a little bit riskier, like maybe you take 25% less damage, but half of the damage that you receive is also deducted from your gold stockpile. So, you know, kind of tying those two currencies together, the health and the wealth. But anyways, it's, you know, I'm not going to be able to explain every clever thing that the game does. But as I was kind of, you know, watching some reviews and stuff about this, it really caught my eye. And I thought that, you know, they're just doing so many clever things that Playwright listeners and particular Playwright hosts might get a lot out of it. So I'll give a hearty recommend to Curse of the Dead Gods.
Curse of the Dead Gods. Wow. I was, it seems like it could be a me kind of game. Is it just on PC right now?
I don't know about that, actually.
I'm going to have to look.
Since it's just coming out of early access, you know what? It looks like it is on PS4, Xbox One, and Switch as well.
Bingo.
Yeah, so I guess pick it up wherever is most convenient for you. But I'm very tempted to get into it myself, but I'm also juggling another playthrough of Dead Cells. I've got Hades still installed. I have...
You're full up on roguelikes.
I was realizing I've only made one like legit playthrough of West of Dead, and so I need to get back to that one as well. Like, I have so many roguelites, and just by nature, like, they just never end. Like, I could still sit down and have a great time with The Binding of Isaac, and that game is like 10 years old at this point, so...
Well, I'll say this, which is I did not expect in 2021 to be of no shortage of top-down slash isometric a kind of action RPGs. These do feel like the modern rev of the action RPG back from its, you know, the Diablo roots of the whole thing. And I think that the roguelike or roguelite formula is it does have a... It's kind of a natural fit if you wanted to potentially make a play forever version of a Diablo or Diablo 2.
Yeah. Did Diablo have roguelite elements? Like, did it have kind of randomized dungeons? I guess that in and of itself isn't what constitutes a roguelike, but did, because I've never really gotten into Diablo all that much.
I'm trying to remember if Diablo 1 or 2 had the concept of you died and had to like corpse run back to get all your equipment again. I think that there was something like that in Diablo, but at this point, I don't trust my... We were talking before the show, but we've replaced information in our brains with the ringtones from online video calling apps. So I think maybe, you know, the Discord tone of do-do-dung is... is probably there where the Diablo information might have been.
All right. Well, we've got more convenient ways to experience Diablo 2 in the future. And then, of course, Diablo 4 is right around the corner as well as a mobile game, which I don't think we've heard that much about since it was announced to resounding criticism.
Yeah. Jeez. They're in a weird state where I'm just like, do you ship games anymore? I feel like I know COVID has been tough on the entire development community. And I do know that so far in 2021, it seems like 2021 is actually manifesting maybe many of the delays that were foreshadowed in 2020. But boy, oh boy, yeah, sometimes I get this feeling of like, are there any games coming out this year? We'll find out. I guess maybe we'll find out near... what the time period that would have been E3, I guess is what we call it now.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a little slim pickings this year. But, I mean, still plenty of great stuff. We had Bowser's Fury and Hitman 3 already. So good year as far as I'm concerned. Complain. And we've got a Psychonauts game this year. What more could we ask for?
Yeah, I was actually going to... It's funny that you said... that we got Mario 3D Land. I know you were talking about this on social media, but boy, oh boy, I didn't realize until someone kind of listed out all of the Wii U ports that were $50 and are now $60 on the Switch. Pretty wild. Pretty wild.
Yeah, it's kind of the courtesy to list remakes and remasters at $40 which is, you know, probably undervaluing the work of the teams that are involved, especially when you have, you know, talented teams like Blue Point porting Shadow of the Colossus and like the Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 1 and 2 is two full games that are among some of the best games ever made, priced at a budget price together in a, you know, beautiful 4K package. So, you know, I'm not going to argue that, like, that is the correct way to do it. But knowing how Nintendo tends to remaster things, which is a little bit like not much shine and polish on it, them charging full whack is, although, I mean, the 3D World, I think, justified itself by including Bowser's Fury, but
yes,
that Skyward Sword thing just still seems like a bit of a piss take.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
They gotta make their money somehow. All right.
Well, I won't linger on the Nintendo stuff, but it did occur to me recently, and I was like, this is a little strange.
Let's get to some video game pitches. I'll be going first today with a game that is like Monkey Ball, but instead of tilting the entire course, like it's a, you know, like one of those old, I don't know if you ever played with these, but they're kind of like marble mazes where you have like knobs on each side and you can tilt this giant kind of wooden labyrinth to guide the marble through it. I like this kind of how I imagine Monkey Ball working is that, you know, the entire course is kind of this big solid object. And then you, the player, are using your kind of lone analog stick to tilt the entire course at once. So unlike that, where you're tilting the entire course with an analog stick, you use the control sticks and analog triggers together to control, I guess, each controls one corner of a rug-like kind of malleable course to guide a marble around obstacles. So, you know, we're abandoning the kind of like solid courses of Monkey Ball and getting into courses that are a little bit more kind of wave-like or have that kind of flexibility and give to them. So seeing how that kind of changes the formula, I'm going to start the clock there. Have I stumped you?
Talk to me a little bit about the twist. Like, I want to, in your mind, like, what is, I don't know, I need a shred more.
Honestly, this is inspired by a very kind of tangible experience that I've had. Like, I'm moving house at the end of this week. And so I'm thinking about kind of packing up all of my equipment and all of my electronics and stuff like that. And so I have a ton of wires that I need to transport somehow. And so I bought a packet of like Velcro wire ties.
Oh yeah.
Just to kind of keep things in order and to, you know, potentially kind of bundle them once I get to the new place so that I don't just have like wires going everywhere behind the television. They all came, I got like a pack of 60. And they all came like stuck together, like a, it's kind of hard to describe,
yeah,
just kind of one
roll
on top of the other. Yeah. So, it's kind of like a sheet of paper almost with all of them stuck together as such. Like, it's also kind of like very pleasing to just like play with in my hands. And I noticed kind of as I was playing with it, it has that thing where you can kind of like tilt one side one way and the other side the other way and watch it kind of twist like a helix in the center. And I was thinking, like, it would be kind of interesting to try to control or balance something that's kind of suspended in the middle of, like, a malleable surface like that, you know? Like a surface that can really kind of twist and turn. And, yeah, is this making more sense?
Yeah, it totally is. So one of the things that comes to my mind now, and sorry for drawing that out of you. I know that was... one of the things I'm thinking about in terms of that like marble zone run type of thing, all of those games are really dealing with two dimensions, right? There may be some, 3D-ness to the presentation, but generally you're pivoting on an X and Y axis and controlling an object around that. But I think now what we're really talking about is adding that third dimension in there. And could there be depth? Could I, the player in this marble zone thing, do what you've done with some of these Velcro ties, which is, could I twist some of the walls? Could I alter them? Obviously not in a way that's going to like break things and just have me get straight to the end game or whatever, or straight to the goal. But is there like an up and down type of navigation that can also occur?
Yeah, Monkey Boss always had a three-dimensional element to it. You know, you'll see, especially in the speedruns, there's a lot of verticality to the way that they play. You know, they find ways to launch their monkey off of corners and to get them like flying in the air and then landing just before the goalpost, like in ways that seem like magic to people who aren't monkey ball experts. But so, there's always been kind of verticality involved in that. But I think there's something about the, like the course being solid that feels kind of safe and predictable. Like if you angle it downwards, you know that the monkey is going to roll in that direction. It's essentially the same thing as picking up speed on a flat course. Whereas if you are kind of twisting the angles of a malleable surface, not only are you picking up speed in what would otherwise be a static course, but you're also changing the layout of the course itself and potentially moving obstacles, you know, building hills, really kind of reshaping the landscapes in ways that I hope feels kind of precarious at first, but empowering once you come to grips with the mechanics.
I love the idea of being able to, is this almost like a VR thing in your mind where you are able to go in and kind of dream style, bend and mold the course in different ways?
I mean, potentially that's one way to do it, you know, because you have four corners that you need to kind of keep track of mm-hmm. all at once, which is a challenge to be overcome. I had kind of like in my mind mapped it out to like the bottom two corners are mapped to the analog sticks and the top two corners are mapped to the analog triggers.
Oh, wow.
Because those are the analog inputs. But like, I'm really open to like if they were VR controllers, then you could have the top two corners mapped to your hands movements and the bottom two mapped to the control sticks. So whatever kind of like analog, I mean, you could even map them to like foot pedals from a racing game setup or something like that. You know, I'm really open to any kind of analog setup we can throw at it.
I love the idea of being able to, I wish the joysticks could do this, but almost have knob like control. I kind of want that turning, because I think that would feel right as we bend and contort this stage. I'm also thinking about, like, speaking of 3D world that we mentioned earlier in the show, what a really cool thing to me would be to bring in the some of the, like, that Mario cherry power up and do some of the Arkanoid brick breaker type of power ups where you can multiply the amount of marbles, or you can go out of your way to get a power up and smash through walls and that sort of thing.
I really like how that type of thing is incorporated into Super Mario 3D World on our previous subject. Like when you catch those cloning cherries that just turn you into like two Luigis at once. And they're
kind of splitting
tell
the Marios to get on the pads.
Yeah. There are kind of different philosophies. There's the puzzle courses where you have to like protect your Marios and make sure that you have enough to get, you know, activate special lifts at the end of the stage by, you know, very carefully platforming around the stage. And then there's that one boss that is like a clown made of molten goo that gives you the cherries just because they know that you're going to get hit. And so it's a way of like mitigating the damage almost, which, anyways, unimportant. I think kind of a pinball grounding is a good way to look at this as well. Like, you know, I'd love for, you know, especially if the course is kind of malleable and especially if it was kind of grounded in like household materials, like a lot of games are these days, you know, with Little Big Planet and Yoshi's Woolly World and stuff like that, that feel tangible because they're made of materials that you're familiar with from your real life. If you're a preschool teacher, it could be fun to be able to expose like tears or holes in the course by, you know, bending it in ways that might seem counterintuitive. Like it seems like there's a lot of kind of open-endedness to this exploration that this very analog control of the course that you have could could elicit.
And I even love the idea of taking a toggle based approach of like, if the bending and twisting is all mapped to both analog triggers and joysticks, and so you have a lot of bend and warp control over each of the corners, then maybe you could do something where you go and use the bumpers or something to toggle corner to corner to corner, and now you have 4 points of analog articulation per corner.
4 points per corner? Yeah, I guess.
Twist, a bend, a rotate, all of that. It's almost like the Photoshop puppet warp tool. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
It almost kind of like you could switch between the corners like you would if you're controlling Octodad if you're controlling Mount Your Friends or something like that.
Totally. Anyway, that's where my head's at.
That's right. So let's go ahead and close that one down and let's come up with a name for it.
I feel like there's a bend zone or twisted. We haven't had a twisted in a while.
Or if there's a curtain roll or paper roll, like are there any materials that roll could be added to that make sense? Felt roll.
Felt roll. Of course I go into like marble roll or metal.
I was thinking like the roll could be the kind of pun that connects, because the roll is the verb that the ball is taking. And if you have a roll of fabric, you know, that's kind of where my head's at. I mean, fabric roll, probably it's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. We can do something here. Oh, is this a table roll? And then there's even like a dinner pun in there?
Dinner roll. Dinner roll would be kind of fun if, let's see.
Or table roll. Table roll is what.
Table roll. Table roll. Does that mean anything? I'm going to do a quick Google. Okay, because.
There's like rolls for the table.
See, if table roll by itself meant something, then I think it would be on to something there.
Cloth roll?
Or fabric roll or felt roll?
Velcro?
Wow. Boy.
Yeah. Velcro. Okay. All right. I need to get on my game tonight, obviously.
I mean, I like that word. I don't know if it means anything here, but I like the word.
Velcro zone.
Velcro zone. How about just like craft roll? That seems pleasant. Craft roll.
And more importantly, it hits those dinner vibes like I was talking about.
Yeah, because you can spell it with a K and get your brand recognition in there. Okay. What are you bringing us today?
So I have this week something that I suspected maybe we've talked about before, but maybe we can go in a different direction. A few weeks ago, spent a session in Sea of Thieves and had the whole big fish show up. And I know there's like a Kraken type of thing in that game. That combined with the Assassin's Creed games and all of these games where there's sort of sailing mechanics, I'm thinking, would it be cool to have a monster hunter, but at sea? And you're going around finding these giant sea creatures in the open sea. You can imagine it would almost be more of an open world monster hunter rather than a region by region. And go around defeating these sea creatures, maybe using their parts to upgrade the boat.
All right, starting the clock. We've had underwater fights in Monster Hunter before. I think starting in, I'm wondering if it was in Monster Hunter Tri or if that was like a brand new addition into bits of Monster Hunter 3 when they ported it to Wii U. I don't remember what that was called, if it was 3 Ultimate, might have been. But there have been underwater Monster Hunter fights, but I also like this idea of kind of anchoring, to use a pun there, everything around a boat. You know, it feels like, you know, having to kind of like stay close to the boat, make sure it doesn't drift away, maybe not having the full range of mobility underwater unless you're tethered to things that kind of keep you close to the boat. You know, maybe even having those kind of like diving cages that they used to go and hunt sharks and stuff like that.
Oh, that's a great idea. I could even see the boat having to play some kind of pivotal role in combat. So in the same way that the Monster Hunter games are very much about what type of weapon that you decide to roll, I could see a variation of like, depending on the type of boat that you've done and having multiple people team up, if these are more like single or a couple person crafts each, you know, in Sea of Thieves, you have the size ships, but the size ships are, they also mean a certain thing for weaponry, maneuverability, speed, that sort of thing. So I wonder if we could have different types of vessels that might be good for hunting different types of monsters.
That's a good idea as well. So, you know, having to plan things out ahead of time, you know, an interesting part of like whale hunting as well, and not something that I would condone any of our listeners participate in real life, but
play this, you know, game instead.
As you've seen it in Assassin's Creed and other games of the sort, is using harpoons that have the ropes attached to them so you can kind of tie down and limit the movement of one of these larger animals.
Yeah.
You know, thinking about, there's kind of a natural risk reward there of, you know, as you tie it down, you're kind of necessarily linking the fate of your own boat to the fate of the creature. You know, if it is able to pull away and dive, then it might bring your boat down with it. Like, there's a good kind of risk reward there.
Yeah, I think getting to a feeling of also chasing in the creature and deploying nets and things. So you're kind of, maybe you set up your battle by establishing a perimeter, that sort of thing. And then, of course, you know, while between places, I love the idea of really actually kind of capturing a Wind Waker-like feeling of, you can kind of travel from island to island. Maybe the islands have different vendors and stuff that you go to, and different vendors will give you different rates on monster parts, that sort of stuff. Or they just have different equipment available. But, you know, to pass the time, instead of, you know, picking things off of bushes, you're going fishing. You know, there's a great fishing mini game in there, and that's how you're, you know, potentially, you know, catching bigger and bigger fish, getting different types of bait to lure in these larger monsters.
Of course, kind of using bait, I think, is a nice way to increase the size and the scope of the monsters that you know, because in Monster Hunter, you visit new lands, which unlock new varieties of monsters, which I think obviously would still be a consideration here. You can kind of travel, but if this is kind of entirely ocean-based, like a water world type of setup, like, there's not a lot of differentiation that you can really do between different lands, at least at the surface level as you're traveling around. So, you know, even if you were confined to a relatively small patch of water, the ability to use bait from smaller monsters to attract larger monsters, or the ability to increase your kind of pressure resistance to be able to go deeper, I think are both really exciting ways to ground the exploration.
Oh man, imagine if you had, by the end of the game, you had the Cracktown style, like, transforming vessel of sorts that could put itself in a bubble, or deploy kind of a bubble around it so that it could start venturing underwater, and you could discover whole underwater land masses deeper and deeper, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so I haven't played as much Subnautica as you have. Is there anything that we can kind of learn from that one? Or, you know, that one is very kind of Minecraft-like in that it's a lot about, you know, gathering resources and building, and the perspective is based around first person, whereas something like this, I think, would be more of a third person action-based exploration type of game. But I'm wondering if there are things that we could take from Subnautica, like how they deal with oxygen, how they keep combat fresh as you fight some of the, I don't know if they do even.
Yeah.
I haven't encountered big enough monsters to need to fight.
I think the one of the things that we could probably pull from Subnautica, and actually pull from Waterworld fiction, which may be where Subnautica pulled it from, is I love the idea of everything really being crafted from the sea, from your surroundings. If you're going to repair your boat, can you find driftwood, or can you build up pieces of your boat with coral and that sort of thing? Maybe, you know, obviously in Monster Hunter, we have buffs and stuff, and we eat meals before a thing. Well, we also need to be eating food this whole time too. And maybe there's even a fresh water or sun exposure mechanic that could play into this. Gosh, we'd probably have to recycle our own urine, which is just, that ends up in every post-apocalyptic fiction, I feel. And probably one day in real life. Hopefully not in a post-apocalyptic setting. But yeah, what Subnautica does really well is force you to eventually you work up to crafts, but you're constantly having to leave the craft, venture down to gather a resource, and you're very vulnerable. Obviously, it's not your natural habitat when you're in the water. But they also have base building, too, which I do think is very compatible with the sort of Monster Hunter formula. Like, okay, now I've, you know, on my series of interconnected rafts that I've assembled, I've finally got a blacksmith. And so now I can, you know, upgrade my harpoons and that sort of thing.
So would there be, you know, with boats, you're not really, you know, confined to the land and the way that, you know, the land would necessarily kind of halt your expansion due to mountains and other types of natural features. You know, the ocean is kind of a flat space that you can continue to kind of build your boat out upon. Is this something you could see being kind of a base builder as you go? Maybe kind of a free form. You can build your boat in ways that both allow for your own survival and make for the easier hunting of these larger monsters, or even the kind of smaller, you could put nets out that allow you to catch creatures that you can use as bait, but really kind of building your ship in the way that best suits you.
One of the things that I think we could lift directly from Monster Hunter is the, once you get a little bit later in Monster Hunter, you really start encountering a lot of surprise. A different monster has showed up, and now the monsters are fighting, you know, each other. And I wonder if there's like a way to work your way up the bait scale and pool, and you probably also need to establish your own fish farm in some way, in the same way you could kind of do a resource farm in Monster Hunter. But taking those fish and kind of kiting one large fish towards another so that you can get them to battle, and maybe that's the only way to defeat other fish, is you really have to start doing almost like what tuna fishermen do, using a radar type of system, and then seeing, maybe, you know, you're just seeing kind of a blob and you don't know if what's down there is a giant coral reef, if it is a sunken ship, or if it is a fish that is just so big and scary it'll swallow you and maybe your ship whole. It'd be fun to do kind of a, you know, a late game twist of a single like Moby Dick like moment where you get swallowed up by a giant fish and have to fight it from the inside. Very Zelda-ish as well.
That takes us to 10 minutes. Let's come up with a name for this one.
God, we have Monster Hunter. Is this Kraken Hunter? Is this Leviathan Hunter? What?
Leviathan is a nice name.
Maybe it's just Leviathan.
Leviathan, yeah, I think on its own is a nice one. I think we can just use that then. All right, we'll call that one Leviathan, and we'll move over to our community. This was something that I think was just kind of incidentally sent our way. This was a tweet from somebody at me, actually, who mentioned that, just kind of started combining games in a fun way and thought that it would be a fun thing to include on Playwright, and I agreed. So this comes from Gassy the Cat, who says, the Octoman track you played from F-Zero GX, this was a reference to a Sound of Play feature that I included a track from one of the F-Zero games a while back. The Octoman track you played on F-Zero GX could be slipped into the Crypt of the NecroDancer series, and hardly anyone would know. Uh-oh, is this one for Playwright? Lap of the Airbrake Snaker, rhythm action meets anti-grav racing. Anyways, I just thought that was really interesting, this idea of we talked about turn-based racing games in the past, but never before grounded in this kind of rhythmic or real-time turn-based type of setup that NecroDancer brings to it. And I think that might be kind of the key that ties it all together. So let's go ahead and start the clock on that one and see what more we can bring this idea.
One of the things that this, you know, immediately conjures in some ways is Thumper. Just because of how Thumper feels is both, it almost does feel like a racing game, but has that kind of left and right track snapping feeling of a rhythm game. And so I'm wondering, like, is there something to be learned from, like, how could we control acceleration in a way? I feel like that's a big part of it.
Yeah, so, you know, if we're thinking about this in a turn-based type of format, then, you know, kind of a grid based game, I think makes a lot of sense here. You know, on the beat of the music, you choose how you want to, like, what the next action is that you want to take, whether it's going forwards, whether it's starting your turn with a drift, whether it's making a harder turn without a drift, you know, all these types of like verbs that you're choosing from in your head in real time in a racing game would be kind of turn-based here. And, you know, due to the kind of extra time you have to think on each turn, would have to be more precise and demanding.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about like some of my favorite racing game mechanics, and I don't know if F-Zero has these, but like hitting, I think I remember F-Zero GameCube anyway, having things like boost pads or having jumps and that sort of thing. And I'm thinking about the clicky feeling that Necrodancer gives you. So as long as you're you're kind of forward, but you're going top down. So that makes me, although can we represent anti-gravity top down, I think is the challenge.
I think we've seen it before, you know, this is maybe not the best example, but the F-Zero game, mini game in Nintendo Land on the Wii U was top down. You know, the F-Zero games on Game Boy Advance and Super Nintendo are behind the car, but they're kind of like high enough elevation to where like the shift in perspective really wouldn't make like a tremendous amount of difference, I think, to the way that you control and play. And I mean, we've seen actually another game that I've been playing recently is, I'm not going to remember what it's called. I'm going to look it up. I have it on the Epic Games Store.
Oh no.
Just a moment while I wait for this to load. It is by the makers of Absolute Drift. It is called The Art of Rally. Yes, Art of Rally. That is a top-down rally racing game. So, you know, it's not quite cross-country in that you're not, you know, 4x4ing over your rough terrain, but it is, you know, you are alone in the course. You're just trying to get the best time on what are, you know, these kind of really tight and windy courses carved through the mountains and the fields of, you know, these lush and beautiful countries. It's a really kind of nice, really kind of meditative racing game. And so something like that, I think, could really be translated into a turn-based format because, you know, in Art of Rally, especially like, and in F-Zero GX as well, deciding how far ahead of the turn you start your drift and deciding, you know, when you reapply the gas, like there's a lot of decisions that could really be boiled down to like a grid-based format and still retain a lot of their tension. You know, they could even be, we could even investigate like adding cards into this, like it was Slay the Spire or something like that. But I think like you really could boil down those racing mechanics into a turn-based format and still make it very, very tense.
I almost am a little bit inspired by the idea of, and I think Art of Rally is what a beautiful game, but so many racing games have done this over the years. I think F-Zero also does it. We've seen these games where like, as you're approaching a turn, there'll be like a series of seemingly virtual arrows, illuminated arrows that are kind of like pointing you in a direction. It would be really interesting to me to have the track, you know, pulse in a way, or the way that those arrows themselves have a rhythm as you're driving by them. If there's a way to kind of tap on the throttle or tap on the brake to the beat in order to gain some momentum. So one of the things that I'm for anti-lock brakes, I guess this is true. I don't know if this is true, but if you don't have anti-lock brakes, one of the best things you could do if you need to stop suddenly or you might be getting into an accident is pump the brake, and that ensures that your brakes don't lock up. So maybe there's like a mechanic of pumping the brake to the beat to keep your brakes from locking up, and then pumping the accelerator during a, you know, a race to as long as you're firing on the beat, that is what's kind of building the momentum. And of course, the faster you go, the faster you need to kind of keep up with it.
What would be an interesting challenge is to encourage players to keep the combo going, you know, to perform an action every beat, like in Crypt of the Necrodancer. You know, if you stand still for a beat and let an enemy kind of fall into place, then you lose your combo. It, you know, I think it either reduces your score or it reduces the amount of damage that you're going to do. Or if you had any kind of saved up effects, then it would reset that. So, you know, you want to perform an action every beat, which kind of puts you in a bad place sometimes in Necrodancer because, you know, if an enemy is going to move into your attack zone, then you don't want to move from that attack zone. You don't want to move into theirs, obviously. So it causes a little bit of decision making that you have to perform on the fly. And you could do a similar thing here where, you know, while obviously turning is the greatest challenge for people that are kind of coming to terms with the system, perhaps straightaways are the biggest challenge for the like seasoned and professional players because you know, you can tap on the up arrow a number of times, but as soon as you hit maximum speed, or maybe you don't want to accelerate past a certain threshold because it would make the next turn too sharp to hit. And so, you know, you want to kind of keep your speed within a range of motion so you can either tap forward and backwards to speed up, slow down. Maybe it's zigzagging side to side. Maybe there's a way to perform risky tricks like complete 360 degree turns that take, you know, 4 beats to complete, but they give you a speed boost or other type of bonus on the other side or something like that. Like something, some kind of flourish that people could do, almost like the way that like professional StarCraft players in Korea like hammer on buttons that don't do anything while they're playing just so that they can keep like the momentum and the rhythm of the gameplay up.
I think that's cool. And one of the things that I was thinking as you were saying that, especially about building a combo and keeping a combo going, I like the idea of you having to execute a certain number of beats, or you only have, let's say, 4 bars, 16 beats of any one particular gear on your car, and then you kind of have to shift up or shift down. And shifting up or shifting down is really, it's mostly difficulty control you could tie it to, but you could also maybe have a mechanic of if you go beyond your, you know, 4 bars and you get into 20 beats, 24 beats in the same gear, you kind of risk overheating the engine and, like, you know, slowing down or stalling out for 2 beats or something like that as your racers pass you. So now you could kind of get into the, like, okay, I'm in 5th gear, the beat is going faster and faster, and you could make the music match the intensity, right, of the way it actually feels to drive. I feel like that would capture some old, kind of old school Need for Speed style energy that would be really neat.
Yeah, maybe you could even... maybe there are kind of like Mario Kart style power-ups that you could pick up that allow you to tap out a new BPM on your own controller. And then everyone else has to kind of adjust mentally on their side and perhaps lose a beat or two as they're readjusting to the new BPM. It was just ways to keep it competitive.
To show up.
Yeah. Anyways, that's 10 minutes. Let's give it a name. And, you know, actually, Gassy the Cat did come with a name. Let's see if it still fits. It was Lap of the Airbrake Snaker. That is pretty funny still. I still really like that.
I like it too, and it makes me kind of imagine it's going to have some anime-ass characters in it, so I'm down.
If you would like to submit a video game pitch of your own, and again, as we have demonstrated today, it could be a mashup of games that already exist. It could be something entirely original. It could just be... it could be 3 words that you're stringing together that have no obvious connection. Whatever you want to submit to us, we will gladly take, and we'll read it on the show and make a video game out of it. Results may vary. If you would like to submit something yourself, you can do so by going to playwrightcast.com/pitch. You can tweet us at playwrightcast, or you can email us playwrightcast@gmail.com.
Special thank you to Protodome for the use of our theme song, Hello World, off the album Blue Noise. And when you're listening to things, boy oh boy, there's some banger episodes of Sound of Play, The Sausage Factory, and the Kane and Rince podcast. What have we had recently? Did The Last of Us just drop, Ryan?
You know what happened recently that people might be interested in is Sound of Play recently debuted its 290th episode, where Brian Edwards and Leah Haidu do a nice little march through the music of the numbered entries in the Kingdom Hearts series. So I guess specifically Kingdom Hearts 1, 2, and 3, not numbers that reduce the compound fractions and such like.
DSEAC chain of love and memories.
Yep, 358 over 2 days or whatever. Anyways, so yeah, if you're into Kingdom Hearts music, then Sound of Play 290 is one of those 10th episode specials. And in just 10 more shows, we're going to have to come up with a way to celebrate the 300. So that's going to be a big one. Stay tuned on Sound of Play. We got some exciting stuff coming up, as we always
do. I suggest for episode 300, the other 300 Kingdom Hearts games that are not numbered.
That's right. Actually, I think by the time we get that, we might just be able to hit the actual number of Final Fantasy games. So that might be the perfect way into that. So, all right. To take us out of the show, I'm going to be giving you a redacted game, and let's see if you can guess what it is.
I've got my thinking cap on.
The game today is Join Captain Redacted, Smuggler and Occasional Redacted, as she recruits a ragtag team of redacted-driven redacted and sets out on a daring adventure. With your hardy crew, you'll redacted, loot, and shoot your way through enemy redacted. Overcome the challenges of the vast frontier by upgrading your redacted with unique abilities, weapons, and even stylish redacted.
The first half of this, if you didn't say her, could have still been a Captain Toad game, but this is a different
type. He's known for his looting and shooting, certainly.
Join Captain so-and-so as she. I feel like the she, or for better or worse, video games do not have a lot of Captain She's in there.
I think there are certain genres where that might be more common than, but anyways.
How do you mean?
Doesn't necessarily mean anything. But just racking my brain for kind of counterexamples, I guess I can come up with a few, but you're probably right that it is military ranks are not often bestowed upon women outside of like anime games, I would say. I was thinking of like Valkyria Chronicles and stuff like that.
You may have given me a hint as well where you said military rank. So
or
I'm
maybe throwing you off. Who knows? Could go either way.
That's right.
It's only a hint if you can trust the hinter.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Is this a military style game? I guess, hold on. Wait. Is this a military shooter? Like a Call of Duty?
This is not like a Call of Duty. This is not a... I'll tell you, it's not a first person shooter.
Okay. All right.
And it is not set in a real world military environment. So... not based on real nations or anything like that.
Oh man, then I was gonna go into like, is there a Halo game or a game in like a sci-fi universe? Oh, is this a Mass Effect?
It's a very good guess, but it is not a Mass Effect game.
Oof. Okay. Boy, if this is like if this is a Final Fantasy style game, I might be in trouble. If this is a JRPG, I might be in trouble. Could I get some metadata?
So the page that I have pulled up here is a re-release, not the original platform, but okay. I'm guessing if people are going to play it today, this is probably the platform they're going to be playing it on. So keep in mind that some of these opinions, some of these scores might be influenced by like a lingering affection for a title that they might have had on a previous platform or something like that. But on this edition of the game, it has a 91 Metascore, an 8.5 user score, and this re-release of the game came out in 2017.
A re-release of it came out in 2017.
Mm-hmm. I'll be a bit more specific on that, actually. So it is listed here as the number 4 best Switch game of 2017, number 56 most discussed Switch game of 2017, and number 50 most shared Switch game of 2017. So a bit of a drop off between the quality and most discussed, as you can see, a drop off between the Metascore and the user score as well, but still held in very high regard regardless.
Yeah, it's a great game that not a lot of people talk about, which makes me think it's probably from maybe a smaller developer. But gosh, I'm trying to, the when you're talking about looting and shooting and but it's not first person, I play as a captain. Could you I either probably need the description again or some reviews.
Okay, well, I'll read the description again, see if it awakens anything in your mind. Otherwise, you still have two guesses left, so you've, I think you're...
Oh,
you're...
I thought I had one guess left. That's why I'm...
Your first one was very, like, is it a military?
Yeah.
Like, whatever. I don't...
Yeah, okay.
I don't care.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate it.
Join Captain Redacted, Smuggler, and Occasional Redacted as she recruits a ragtag team of Redacted-driven Redacted and sets out on a daring adventure. With your hardy crew, you'll redacted, loot, and shoot your way through enemy redacted. Overcome the challenges of the vast frontier by upgrading your redacted with unique abilities, weapons, and even stylish redacted.
Okay. I'm a captain. I'm on the frontier?
This is kind of an interesting choice of words, isn't it?
Yeah. With a ragtag team. So I'm with a group. And you said I could upgrade things?
Yeah. Yeah, you could upgrade.
Oh, Ryan, just take... Oh, this came out on Switch and was previously on another platform. Is this The Outer Worlds?
Not The Outer Worlds. But, I like the way you're thinking. I mean, not necessarily that you're getting closer to it, but I like that you're starting to, you know, venture into those. Anyways, I don't know
it
what
sounds,
I'm actually trying to
well,
say.
Well, I'm trying to think of games with loot. I'm there's a Borderlands kicking around in my head, but I don't remember other than Commander Lilith. Mm-hmm. I think it's Commander Lilith, not Captain Lilith. But if it is Captain Lilith, then maybe this is a Borderlands game. But
if you want some reviews, okay, I can read some as well.
Yeah, I think right. I need some reviews before I...
Okay, I'll read a 10 and a 1, I think, is the lowest in the user reviews here. So
ooh.
A 10 says, I was eagerly anticipating this game after being introduced to the Redacted franchise with Redacted, previous game of the franchise. I've always loved strategy games, and this one surpassed my expectations. With difficulty settings to suit veteran gamer or newcomer, and amazing characters and story, I would love a sequel to this game, honestly. And a 1 says, did I play a different game? This game is so unmemorable and impossible to come back and play between playing other actually fun games. This game sucks and should stay in Europe where people think mundane garbage is art.
Wow, scathing. scathing. So, okay, I feel a little bit warmer towards the Borderlands now that I know we're in series territory. I'm trying to think of incredible games that enough people have played.
And now you have a genre to bat around as well.
Strategy. So I was going to go for a series that's near and dear to my heart is SteamWorld. And there's SteamWorld Dig, which I believe you're a cowboy robot. So you're at least a male presenting robot. SteamWorld Dig 2, I believe you're a female robot. And then there's
also kind of also a cowboy, right?
Also a cowboy, which
Captain would
be frontier.
Kind of an odd adjective.
Yeah.
I'm Captain Cowboy. I'm captain of the horse.
Yeah. Captain is strange. So there's also SteamWorld Quest, which I don't know if you're what character that is. I haven't played SteamWorld Quest.
It's kind of a medieval setting.
Yeah, which Captain works there, but Frontier doesn't. And then there was SteamWorld Heist, but I've only known that it's supposed to be good, and I didn't play it because it wasn't a Metroidvania. But that is like a turn-based, I think, or like
that one's a bit. It's kind of like a side-on XCOM kind of.
Oh,
I played like half of it. Haven't finished.
Oh, would you say it is a strategy game? Because
I would put it in a genre myself, but I mean,
okay,
how much do you trust that I'm just going to be talking directly to the answer?
I am going to pick I'm going to say SteamWorld Dig 2. No, I don't have a band of, well, I have buddies in the town is the thing, and I do get upgrades, but it's not strategy. SteamWorld Heist.
SteamWorld Heist, is that the one that you're going with?
Regis, that's my final answer.
All right, well, I'll read the unredacted pitch. Let's see if it panned out for you. Captain, join Captain Piper Faraday, smuggler and occasional pirate, as she recruits a ragtag team of steam-driven robots and sets out on a daring adventure. With your hardy crew, you'll board, loot, and shoot your way through enemy spaceships. Overcome the challenges of the vast frontier by upgrading your robots with unique abilities, weapons, and even stylish hats. Great job.
Wow. Oh my gosh. And I haven't played it.
That's worth checking down.
Shame on me, because I love SteamWorld. Dig SteamWorld Dig 2. And it's also one of those series that, you know, I constantly point to of like, I can't believe more people are not playing these games, because they're at least the ones that are Metroidvanias are top tier Metroidvania to me.
Yeah, really interesting.
I guess now
games.
I owe them a purchase of SteamWorld Heist.
You know, the SteamWorld games are kind of like the Supergiant games, where they're consistently really good at all the very different things that they try to do. But I think like how often they jump around in different genres kind of puts people who were previously fans off from picking up the next one. And so there will be critically acclaimed games from a developer you already know that you love, like SteamWorld Heist or like Pyre from Supergiant, that people just like don't play for whatever reason. And I would definitely give this one a high recommend. It's one that I've always intended to go back and finish. I don't know why I haven't. I think I got to a certain point where I think there's a little bit of like level grind in the middle that kind of gates progress. And maybe I just wasn't in the mood for it at the moment, but really, really good game from what I played. And I'd be curious to get your take on it when you do finally sit down and give it a go.
Get this. I know it. I know listeners are going to miss it in time, but maybe I'll tweet this out or something right now, because on Nintendo Switch, according to the website DekuDeals.com, which is a great website, go check it out, SteamWorld Quest right now is $12.50. Mm-hmm. Dig 2 is $8. Heist is $5. And the honestly incredible SteamWorld Dig is $2.50.
Wow.
So it does say sale ends March 1st for all of these. So I do think people might miss it.
SteamWorld Heist really came to prominence and popularity on the PS Vita, is where a lot of the people who became the vocal evangelists played it themselves. And so, you know, the Nintendo Switch kind of being the modern day PS Vita would probably be a great place to play it.
Yeah, that's how I played. I experienced Dig on the Vita, just one big long play session, or maybe a couple play sessions. But yeah, now you can get all four of them for what, 15? 20 under $30 for four. I assume Heist is great, but at least two incredible games. And I hear good things about Quest. I hear good things about Heist. 91, what'd you say? 91?
Yeah, 91 for critics, 8.5 from users. I mean, still nothing to sneeze at, even though it's a lower score.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Oof. All right. I'm coming for you next week.
All right. Good one. I like these real clutch victories. This is the best.
In the nth degree. Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, we'll dwell on it.
We'll catch you next time. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.